Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. This time, Monday through Friday each day, and I think we're gaining listeners. I certainly hope so. We try to put out important information that people need to know about, and today is certainly a good example of that. My guest is Thomas Greco, Jr. Tom is a community and monetary economist. He's an educator, a writer, a consultant. He's also a former tenured college teacher with over 30 years' experience studying and writing about ways to improve greater harmony, these are his words, greater harmony, equity, and sustainability through business and economics. And his special expertise is monetary and financial structures, and we sure need a lot of expertise in that, of the good kind, of course. Tom has a new book out. It's called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, and that's what we want to talk about today and the ideas that Tom has in it. Tom, I welcome you to the program.
Hello, Stephen. Thank you.
Oh, it's terrific having you on. And we certainly agree. We have a financial mess on our hands. We have we have a financial system that if it has a genius, Tom, its genius is causing crises like the kind we're in right now. Although this one is really a colossal one.
Absolutely. We've had recurrent crises over the decades, and it's part of the inherent feature of the system.
And the things that you propose are a way out of this. There's so much in your book. What I really want to spend most of the hour on is turning you loose to explaining the most important ideas in your book, because there's so much, and we can get bogged down in a lot of details. So you're the best one to cut through a lot of the less important things to get to the most important parts. And we have four breaks in the hour, Tom. When you hear soft music, that'll be the first one coming, so I'll cut in and we'll take a break and come back. But start off talking about the idea behind the book and what you want to accomplish through it.
Okay, well, I'll talk on and I'll count on you to chime in when I run out of breath.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, well, I've been working on the money problem, as I call it, for about 30 years now. And I got focused on that through my work in the peace and justice movement, and as a result of discovering fairly early on that there were a number of dysfunctional aspects to our money and banking system. I guess one of the first things that alerted me to that fact was a booklet that was put out by the House Committee on Money and Finance, or Banking and Finance. And that was under the chairmanship of Congressman Wright Patman.
Oh, my, a long time ago.
Yeah, this booklet was put out in the early 60s, and he was a longtime chairman of that committee in Congress. And he put out a book, well, the committee put out a book called Money Facts. And I later discovered that that was a Q&A extract of a larger book or booklet called A Primer on Money. So I managed to get a copy of that from the U.S. government printing office and studied it thoroughly. And that began to open my eyes to the fact that there were really severe dysfunctions inherent in money and banking as it operated and still operates today. So I made this the focus of my research. And I started looking into the nature of the system and trying to understand as best I could how it operated.
Let me interrupt briefly. That music means a break.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Tom Greco talking about his new book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. One comment, Tom, Wright Patman He survived. He was lucky. He was a pretty strong critic of the Federal Reserve System. Usually people like that get drummed out of politics pretty fast. Like Congressman Democrat Jerry Voorhees, who was the one that whom Richard Nixon defeated in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon, I guess, came out of the Navy. I think it was the Navy, and Voorhees was unfairly portrayed as a leftist. Communist implications, a terrible campaign. But Voorhees was another a strong critic of the Federal Reserve System, and that's probably what did him in.
Yeah. Well, there's a long history of that kind of political shenanigans to remove opponents from positions of power. Fortunately, today we have one long-standing congressman from Texas, Ron Paul, who has also been an outspoken critic of the Federal Reserve and has repeatedly called for the Fed to be audited, at least, if not abolished. And he's been gaining a lot of attention lately. So there are others in Congress that have come and gone that have tried to raise the alarm and to get people's attention about the need for reform. My particular approach goes beyond reform. I have very little hope that we can achieve anything through the political system at this point to change the monetary system, because money has been completely politicized over the many decades since the Civil War, actually, and even before. And I go into that history in my book. The Federal Reserve was not the first central bank in the United States. Immediately following the Revolution, we had a central bank called the First Bank of the United States, and that was followed by the Second Bank of the United States. And both of those had 20-year charters. In those days, corporations didn't get perpetual life, which was certainly a better situation than we have now. In any case, the Second Bank of the United States needed to be rechartered in 1836 when its charter ran out. And Nicholas Biddle, who was the president of the Second Bank at that time, thought that he could get the recharter bill through Congress early. So in 1832, he started pushing for Congress to recharter the bank. Just one fly in that ointment, Andrew Jackson came to be elected as president in 1828, and during his reelection campaign in 1832, he made the bank an issue. He contended that the bank was a private power that was vying with the elected government for control of the United States. And I don't think that was any exaggeration of the situation. And Congress did pass the bill to recharter the bank, but Jackson vetoed it.
By the way, Tom, Jackson did not mince words. He called that bank a hydra-headed monster.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh.
Please continue.
And he said to the bankers that they were a den of vipers and that he would cast them out. So he managed single-handedly to kill the central bank. And we had a period after that called the free banking era, or the wildcat banking era. That's a rather pejorative term imposed by the opponents of free banking. And, you know, it's a little known fact that there was an assassination attempt on Jackson. Whether it was connected to the money power or not, it was never determined, but, you know, you could speculate about that if you want. Fortunately, the two pistols that the assassin or the would-be assassin used both misfired. So it was really sort of a miraculous thing that Jackson survived that assassination attempt. So anyway, we have this history of central banking throughout the world. Actually, the Central Bank of the United States was modeled after the Bank of England, which was founded in 1694, and that came to be when William III ascended to the throne of England, and he was fighting a war against France. And war, of course, is a very expensive proposition. He needed money to continue to fight the war. Well, William Patterson and some of his financial cohorts got together, and they came to the king with a proposition. And they said, King, we will give you the money you need to fight the war if you will give us the privilege of creating banknotes and lending them into circulation. So you had, at that point, the creation of this collusive arrangement between politics and finance, between government and the banking establishment. And on the one hand, the government got to spend as much money as it wanted, because that money could be created now by the central bank. And on the other hand, the bank, for its part, got to create money basically out of nothing and charge interest on it. Now, I say out of nothing, but that's really not an accurate statement. It can be kind of misleading. Every unit of money is created on the basis of something. And it's the basis on which money is created that is the all-important factor that people generally overlook. So when a bank creates money, it creates it on the basis of some kind of asset. Now, what is an asset to a bank is something like a mortgage note or a bond or some other promise by someone to pay. So when you go to the bank and you say, I want a loan to buy a house, you sign a mortgage note, and the bank will give you the money. Let's say it's a $200,000 loan to buy the house. And the bank makes two entries on its books. Your mortgage note, which you sign and hand over to the bank, is an asset to the bank. So they enter an asset on their books, $200,000, and at the same time they create, they create a deposit to your account, another $200,000 on the liability side. So the books are balanced. The bank has this power to create money on the basis of paper promises, whether that's your mortgage note or whether it's a U.S. government bond or some other financial asset. So the point is, some of the money that banks create is legitimate. You know, if it's based on sound paper, sound promises, it's legitimate, and it provides a flexible supply of money to the economy. But when the bank monetizes a government bond, for example, that's an illegitimate creation of money, because the government bond, while it puts additional money into circulation, brings no additional goods and services to the market. So you have a dilution in the value of every unit of currency that's already circulating in the market. This is the process called inflation. And it's the same thing that happens when a counterfeiter puts counterfeit money into the economy. When a counterfeiter spends counterfeit money, they're taking goods and services out of the economy, but they have no intention of ever reciprocating, of ever putting goods and services back into the economy and accepting their money back as payment for it. So it's this reciprocity circuit that is all important in the exchange function. And money is intended to facilitate this process of exchange of goods and services and financial obligations. So when banks create money on an unsound basis, like, for example, a U.S. government bond, they are inflating the currency, debasing it, and causing prices to increase.
Oh, indeed. And we have a system run out of the Federal Reserve that is extremely inflation-prone, extremely crisis-prone, and this has been the history since at least the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Oh, some months back, Tom, I did an article, and I think up to the present economic crisis, there were 19 recessions, including the Great Depression, stock market fluctuations, up and downs, occasionally some pretty stiff declines. And the Fed, in theory, was created to smooth out the business cycle and prevent all of this. But the result from the Fed's existence was to achieve exactly the opposite of this. And here we have this today's Hydra-headed monster, a lot greater, a lot more destructive than back in Andrew Jackson's day, that literally brought on the calamity that we're going through right now. And the solution that the Obama administration has followed is exactly the wrong kind of thing to do. Instead of fixing the economy, he's wrecking the economy to resuscitate, to keep these bankers afloat that are just drowning in toxic debt, making them all insolvent. Your approach goes to the local level, the grassroots. Oh, boy, do I endorse a system like that, community banking. Get out from under this terrible top-down approach that's wrecking us and go back and have voluntary and community approaches. We're getting close to another break, but maybe you can explain that music. Here comes.
Okay.
We hear the music strike up.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back.
Talk about what could be done at the grassroots and that people in communities could do it on their own.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to NewsHour. I'm with Tom Greco on his new book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Tom, occasionally we talk on this program about how the great changes throughout history that have taken place in the country have never come from the top down. Those people cling like crazy to the power they have. And the big changes like ending slavery and civil rights, they've always been grassroots movements where enough people worked hard enough, long enough, and they achieved what some people at the time or early on thought to be impossible. So why not the financial system? That could be changed, too.
Sure. Yeah, the website that I set up several years ago is called reinventingmoney.com, and it's basically focused on providing resource materials and direction for people to do just that, to reinvent money. Actually, to transcend money. As I said earlier, I don't have much hope for political approaches to solving this problem. You know, Congress isn't going to do it. The president isn't going to do it. We're going to have to do it ourselves. So I believe in transcending the dominant monetary paradigm and the banking system by local, voluntary, free market approaches to mediating the exchange process. Because the sole purpose of money is to facilitate the exchange of goods and services. Now, we can do that without the use of conventional money, apart from the conventional banking system. And this is not just a harebrained idea. These are things that have been going on for a long time, and we have good examples, historical examples and contemporary examples of systems that do just that. There is an entire industry known as the commercial barter industry or barter exchanges, more appropriately called trade exchanges, that provide cashless trading amongst businesses. That's a business-to-business or B2B system. So there are companies in most every large community that do this. And basically they recruit members, mostly from the retail sector, and these retail establishments then are able to conduct business with one another without paying each other in dollars. They have an internal credit system. When you buy something, your account is debited as it goes down. When you sell something, your account is credited as it goes up. So each Each business has an account which will fluctuate, going up and down according to their sales and their purchases. And no cash, no money is required. Basically, your sales pay for your purchases. And this is a process called credit clearing. And this is the highest stage in the evolution of money. Let me just say a little bit about that history. People generally don't realize that money has evolved over time. And what we used as a medium of exchange in the past, we no longer use as a medium of exchange. Initially, it was commodities. People would accept in payment some commodity that was in general demand. And many things have been used over the years as payment media, hides, nails, bullets, sugar, salt. But as monetary systems became organized, gold and silver, precious metals, tended to be the commodities of choice. So it was still a barter relationship. When somebody paid you for your sheep by giving you some gold coins, they were basically giving you a commodity in exchange for a different commodity. Then banks began to create what we call symbolic money. You would deposit your gold in the bank, and they would give you essentially warehouse receipts or notes that represented the gold on deposit, and those notes could then be used as payment, and whoever you paid could then take the note to the bank and claim gold for it if they wanted to. But bankers found that people rarely came to the bank to claim the gold, so they decided, well, maybe we can issue more notes without the addition of gold reserves. So that became the fractional reserve banking system. What they did, whether it was underhanded and fraudulent or not, is a matter of debate. But the fact is they invented credit money. Now, credit money in itself was a positive development. However, it opened the door for greater abuses by the bankers to create credit money on an improper basis, as we spoke about earlier. So now what we have is entirely credit money. That's the only kind of money that circulates is credit money. We had various kinds of gold standards and gold exchange standards over the years. And finally, President Nixon in 1971 put a complete end to that by saying we will no longer redeem dollars for gold, even if you're a central bank or a foreign government. So that severed the last tie to gold and made the dollar basically a credit currency. And every other political currency around the world is similarly created.
We were running out of gold, I guess, at the time, Tom, and since we had gold-backed currency, we were strained getting out from under that. That liberated us to create money like confetti.
Exactly.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Tom Greco talking about his new book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Oh, pick it up, Tom, from where you left off, if you remember exactly before
okay.
The break.
Yeah, we were talking about the commercial barter industry or the commercial trade exchanges that are operating all over the world now. You've got companies like Barter Card International, IMS, Hitex, and there are dozens of them that I could name. But anyway, these commercial barter exchanges, and I shouldn't call them barter exchanges because that's a misnomer, they are credit clearing exchanges. They go by the name of trade exchanges. And these exchanges provide businesses with a means of paying one another using their own credit rather than using conventional money. So this is a liberating feature of those operations. There are also similar things emerging at the grassroots level, and they have been for the last 25 years. There is a system that originated in Canada called LETS, Local Exchange Trading System, which brings together people in the community to trade with one another, offering what they have and requesting what they need without the use of conventional money as payment. So again, it's when you sell something, your account increases. When you buy something, your account balance decreases. So we have those things coming and going, and most of the grassroots systems thrive for a little while and then they fade away. Like any network, these things have to achieve a critical mass, and many of the grassroots systems have not. The commercial systems generally have managed to get enough membership in order to continue to survive and operate at a profit. So these credit clearing exchanges can be operated on a for-profit basis or a non-profit basis or a cooperative basis. And probably the best example we have of a successful, long-standing credit clearing association is the cooperative credit circle that originated in Switzerland in 1934 during the Great Depression. It was called WIR, W-I-R, which in German means we, and it's also an acronym. I won't try to say the German words, but it was basically a cooperative circle for credit clearing that enabled mostly small and medium-sized businesses to continue to trade with one another, despite the fact that there wasn't enough conventional money, Swiss francs, in circulation at the time. So that that VIR cooperative credit circle has since become a bank. They have a conventional bank charter, but they continue to do the credit clearing process. And they have about 60,000 business members throughout Switzerland. And the last figures I had indicated that they had cleared the equivalent of about $1.3 billion worth of trades in 1 year. So, you know, this proves the concept. It's a good example of what can be done locally to liberate ourselves to some degree from the conventional money and banking system.
Tom, can I throw two things at you? On the
sure.
one hand, the idea of what one state only in the U.S. does, North Dakota. It has a state-chartered bank, and we've discussed it on this program. And on the other hand, Obama's so-called financial reform proposal that's about as opposite of reform as anything I can imagine takes a terrible system and wants to corrupt it incredibly more, like in the U.S. giving more power to the Federal Reserve. My God, it's enough to bring up your lunch or your breakfast.
Truly, truly.
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely horrid. And on the other hand, this idea of a financial stability board we talked about last week, which is maybe doing globally what Obama proposes doing with the Fed in the U.S. But what are your thoughts on a state-chartered bank as one idea versus Obama's proposal?
Well,
I know what you think of Obama's proposal, but comment on that.
With regard to state-chartered banks, yeah, I think chartering banks at a lower level of government is a good idea. The North Dakota case is a bank that's actually owned by the state. It's not only chartered by the state, but it is a state-run bank. And it's a depository for state funds. And that seems to have been a beneficial thing for the residents of North Dakota. Of course, as they say, the devil is in the details, and whether it's beneficial or not depends on how that bank is run, how it's managed.
And if other states chartered their own bank, it's possible they would operate it much different from North Dakota, I guess.
Yeah, it is entirely possible. So that's all I want to say about that. Let's go back to central banking again. You and I certainly agree on the fact that Obama is moving us in the wrong direction by giving the Fed more power. In fact, in my view, and Ron Paul says this too, the Fed should be abolished. What we need to do is to create at the local level, as I said, these exchange credit clearing systems in order to liberate ourselves from the central banking system. The entire purpose, and economists don't talk like this, but the entire purpose of a central bank is to enable the inflation of the currency and then to manage the effects of that inflation. And the Fed can either restrict the money supply or expand the money supply. It has the tools to do this through open market operations, buying and selling government securities, and by dictating interest rates. So the Fed can either cause depression by restricting the money supply, as they did during the 1930s, or they can expand the money supply, inflating the currency and causing price increases. And they typically do both, not necessarily at the same time, but in sequence. Well, we're seeing them do both right now. We're having enormous deficits in the federal government in the federal government budget, and $1 trillion-plus deficits for the foreseeable future. Now, what's that going to do to the value of the money in circulation? You can imagine it would be like the hyperinflation that Germany experienced between World War I and World War II. What's holding prices down right now is the fact that people are being thrown out of work and businesses are going bankrupt. So the private sector, the private productive sector, is being starved for credit while credit is being lavished on the government and the financial sector to bail out the banks. So giving the Fed more power and creating this international regulatory mechanism is going to make it more difficult for people to protect themselves from these machinations and malfeasance by the politicians.
Tom, I think part of the goal of Obama's so-called financial reform is literally to create a greater divide between the select elite at the top 1% or so, and so heavily focused in the financial communities, the big, well, of course, they're right here in the U.S. and the European banks. Japan, and the greater benefits to them, the more harm to ordinary people. And let me throw in one thing. While you were talking just now, I got an email that Bernie Madoff was sentenced to 150 years. My only comment I wish in his place, it was Greenspan, Bernanke, Geithner, Paulson, Larry Summers, And a few other luminaries I can think of. But
that's the rogues gallery.
Bernie Madoff is a piker compared to them.
Truly. Yeah, that's true. Well, let's go back to solutions. You know, in my first book, Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis, which I wrote more than 20 years ago, I suggested that the functions that money is supposed to serve need to be segregated. You know, in Economics 101, you learn that money is supposed to be, number one, a medium of exchange, second, a measure of value, and third, a store of value. Well, if you think about it, these are contradictory functions. If money is to be a medium of exchange, it should be spent. If it's to be a store of value, you want to hold on to it. Now, when money was commodities like gold and silver, yes, it could serve all three of those functions. But we no longer have commodity money, we have credit money. And we have to have an objective way of measuring the value of any credit instrument, including a Federal Reserve note. A Federal Reserve note is just a credit instrument. It's an obligation of the Federal Reserve Bank. And we have to have an objective measure of its value. Legal tender laws prevent that kind of objective measure. You know, when the U.S. dollar was first defined, shortly after the Revolutionary War, it was defined to be a certain weight of silver, 371 and one quarter grains of fine silver, to be exact. And so that was an objective measure of value. And when banks issued banknotes denominated in dollars, they were saying this dollar banknote is worth so much silver, and it could be redeemed for silver on demand. We don't have to have redeemable notes in order to maintain an objective measure of value, however. It's legal tender laws that prevent people from having an objective measure of value for the currency, because governments always want to spend beyond their tax revenues. And the way they force us to accept their debased currency is by saying, you must accept this dollar note just as if it were a dollar silver coin. And so the imposition of legal tender obliterates any value standard. So now the dollar has two meanings. First of all, it's an obligation of the Federal Reserve Bank, and secondly, it's a measure of value. So it's a rubber yardstick because the currency is being continually debased.
But now, because of the debasement, Tom, there's another idea floating around changing from the dollar as a world currency either to a global currency or a basket of other currencies. I like the things that you're talking about, but any thoughts on those ideas or the possibility that something like that could happen?
Yeah, well, those proposals are proposals to keep the system going. You see, money in every country has been politicized. Basically, every country has their central bank, which is independent of the government. Even in cases where the government supposedly owns the central bank, the bankers operate independently, and typically in collusion with the politicians.
Can I throw one thing in? I got an email over the weekend. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but it's probably close. The email said, from somebody I know, it said there are only five nations in the world left without a privately owned central bank, and the countries are North Korea, Sudan, Cuba, Libya, and Iran.
How interesting. That sounds like a familiar list.
Well, I would say that's give those countries a gold star, at least for running a government controlled bank.
Truly. So what we need to do is to segregate these functions of money, and we need to organize locally our own credit clearing exchanges, similar to the Vir Bank in Switzerland. But, you know, even that is not perfect. We need to optimize the design of the exchange system and operate it according to sound banking principles. So eventually we're going to have a different unit of account, one that's objective and based on a commodity definition, even though we don't need to redeem the credits for the commodities.
Sounds awfully interesting. Well, I with everything that you have in your book, Tom, and that we're talking about today in the program, we can take issue with points here and points there, and one person can have one idea of changes over the present system. But you and I and others on this program agree on one thing. We have a system that absolutely is corrupted. It's destructive to the interests of the majority of the people in the country. It's lasted a long time, but over time it is unsustainable. At some point or other, it's going to come down, or we're going to come down, and we absolutely need an alternative to this system. So if they won't give it to us from the top down, which they will not, then we, as you propose, have to construct it from the bottom up.
Yes, and this is being done, as I said earlier. And right now the challenge before us is to organize in our communities on a broad basis. We have to bring all elements of our communities together to liberate the credit commons, as I put it. You know, the credit commons is that common pool of credit which supports every money system. Even the Federal Reserve notes are supported by our common credit. The way I put it is this. We give our credit to the banks, and then we beg them to lend some of it back to us at interest. Now, we can take control of our own credit. We can reclaim the credit commons and allocate credit to whomever we wish within our communities and do it on our own terms for our own purposes. So by organizing these credit clearing exchanges, we can achieve that. In the current surge for building community and relocalizing economics, this is an essential element. We're not going to achieve much in the way of local power until we take charge of the money power, which is reclaiming the credit commons and using our own credit for beneficial local purposes.
There's no question. So the money power is central to everything, the air in our lungs or the blood in our veins. And you either have it right or you have it wrong. And we could have an ideal. We could have a far better system if we at the grassroots controlled it with some of the ideas that you're talking about. We need to take another break. We'll come back for a short segment, and maybe you can summarize with your key thoughts. So,
this is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to News Hour, final segment with Tom Greco and his new book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Quick comment, Tom, then you wrap up. I think the Bernie Madoff sentence today, I think he's a metaphor for what's wrong with our system. I saw a number, whether it's true or not, that he was worth $170 billion. The SEC, the powers that be that run the financial system, they knew what he was doing all these decades. They didn't lift a finger to stop him. They let him run this Ponzi scheme, steal billions of dollars, and some of them were profiting right along with him. So it was a lovely system where the big boys make money, and the system is great until it isn't great anymore. Well, the Fed does the same thing nationally and really on a global scale, because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. The whole bloody thing is corrupted. So Bernie Madoff goes down. Well, do we need to wait another century before the whole system goes down? I hope not. You finish up.
Okay, well, the whole system is intended to centralize power and to concentrate wealth, and it's been doing that very successfully for decades. What we need to do is to devolve power to the local communities. If we're going to be anything but serfs in a global economic system, we're going to have to take charge of the credit commons and devolve power to the local communities. Now, one of the chapters in my book, chapter 16, talks about a five-stage prescription for community economic development. And I just want to go through those steps very quickly. But I also want to point out that you can read this on my blog, beyondmoney.net. If you go to excerpts, you will see it, beyondmoney.net. Also, my website is called reinventingmoney.com, and you'll find other of my writings and others on that website.
We've got less than 2 minutes to go, Tom, so I'll let you summarize.
So the way we can go about this in developing community economies is, first of all, to promote import substitution. That is, find out who's doing business in the community, who's selling what, who's buying what, where are they sourcing their purchases, where are they selling their products, is it locally or outside the community. But once you get these businesses doing more business with one another, then you give them an alternative means of payment, which is the credit clearing exchange that we spoke about earlier. And Once that is operating successfully, then you can issue a supplemental regional currency on the strength of the members of that credit clearing association. You can externalize the credit of the members of the association by using banknotes or some kind of a stored value card to buy things from non-members of the exchange. At the same time, you can begin to develop the social capital within the community and basic support structures that strengthen the local economy and enhance the community's quality of life. Things like a community bank that would allocate your local savings to local investment in new productive capacity. So we have to save locally, we have to spend locally, we have to invest locally. And that's the way we enhance our local economies.
Oh, I see, a big amen to that. I just want to mention your book again. The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. The publisher is Chelsea Green. You can go to the website, chelseagreen.com. C-H-E-L-S-E-A Green Publishing, or chelseagreen.com. And I guess on Amazon people can get it as well, Tom.
Yeah, Amazon has a number of book reviews that would be interesting for people to read.
Oh, that sounds great. The music means they'll break away. I just want to thank you for coming on. It was a great hour with you, Tom.
It's been my pleasure, Steve.
Oh, I thank you very kindly for doing it. This is the kind of information we want to get across to people. So I encourage people, come on back tomorrow. We'll have another important guest and topic. Join us then. Again, Tom, many thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.